Hey, it's Natasha Cherney from the Brodet Nation podcast, where I interview everyday women who own their stories. I've talked to military veterans, entrepreneurs, stay-at-home moms, fitness gurus, single ladies, and many more. My goal is to talk to as many different women as I can on issues that are important to their story and hopefully yours too. Listen on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, and Stitcher. Follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Brodet Nation. For more information, visit my website, www.brodetnation.com.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about Sylvia Rivera.
And I'm going to be talking to you about Benedetta Carlini.
Yes, ma'am. It is an LGBT episode.
And get ready.
Get ready. I'd like to preface this by saying, if you remember back to season one, I believe, we talked about Marsha P. Johnson.
Yeah.
Marsha P. Johnson figures heavily into the story of Sylvia Rivera, not least of which because they were basically best friends. I mean, they did almost everything together.
Awesome.
Now, Sylvia was born Ray Jose Christian Rivera Mendoza. And again, I'm not going to refer to that name ever again because it's not the name that she chose eventually.
Got it.
So she's born July 2nd, 1951. And at the age of three, her mother, who was 22 at the time, was in a second marriage, which was not going very well, poured a glass of milk, poured rat poison into that milk, drank it, and offered Sylvia the other one. Sylvia took a couple sips. They both went to the hospital. Sylvia had her stomach pumped, and her mother died 2 days later.
Oh my God.
3 years old. This is how her story begins.
Yikes.
Now, Sylvia had a younger sister as well. Mm-hmm. They went to live with their grandmother because their father kind of just disappeared, didn't want anything to do with them, and never paid child support, never anything. So she moved in with her grandmother called Viejita, which means old lady, even though she was only in her 40s. It's kind of like the nickname that she went by.
Right.
And she really had a very rough, I mean, her entire life was very rough. I mean, she started wearing her grandmother's makeup. She was very effeminate growing up. Mm-hmm. She only was in school till she was in the sixth grade. Mm. She was actually known as an athlete. She did track and she did gymnastics. And her grandmother really disapproved of the effeminate ways, disapproved of the fact that she had darker skin than she would have liked because of colorism within communities of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Her half-sister ends up being taken away, and her grandmother ends up resenting Sylvia even more. In fourth grade, she starts wearing makeup to school. In sixth grade, she gets into a fight with a guy who called her a faggot. Beat him up, actually won the fight, and then subsequently dropped out of school at the age of 11. She found her way to 42nd Street, which at the time in New York was where all the gay population hung out.
Mm-hmm.
And she was basically adopted by a group of queens. Now, she did not, I mean, this is not an easy life. She had sex for the first time when she was seven with her cousin. And then she moved in at 11 with a man named Gary, who she ended up staying with for 7 years till she was 18. They both hustled. They both did drugs. They became well known in Times Square. And eventually it was this group of drag queens she was adopted by who convinced her to take a new name, Sylvia. And she chose Sylvia because, you know, essentially it came down to no one else had the name Sylvia. So she took it. And they had a whole christening for her.
Aww.
She wore a white gown. There was a preacher from a local Pentecostal Hispanic church. And she became Sylvia Lee Rivera. By now, she'd also met Marsha P. Johnson, who was 7 years older at the time, but acted as her drag mother, kind of showed her the ropes, and got her a job at a restaurant called Child's Restaurant. It was a chain of restaurants at the time, first as a messenger, and then eventually she was promoted to billing, working in a full suit and tie with a full face of makeup at the same time.
Beautiful.
Her activism begins during the civil rights movement. I could talk about the childhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is just more of the same in terms of her childhood. The reason why I really wanted to talk about Sylvia is because of her activism. Sylvia is basically the reason we use the word transgender now instead of transvestite. It's recognized as being two separate things. And if you refer to someone who's transgender as transvestite, it is an incredibly uncouth term to use now because it does mean something completely different. And it's pejorative at this point, right, to use it that way. Now, 1969, this is 8 years later, we get to the Stonewall Riots.
Right.
Now, we did talk about the Stonewall Riots with Marsha P. Johnson, and Sylvia's presence at the riots is kind of debated. She was there, but we don't know if she was there on the first day or not. In fact, there is some stories where she personally confided to some of her friends at the time that she wasn't there. But
who knows
at this time. The story in Marsha's story, I remember saying that Marsha P. Johnson is the one who actually started the throwing,
right,
of the first brick, where it was a shot glass at a mirror and she screamed, "I got my civil rights." In 1970, the next year, of course,
right,
Stonewall Riots are known as starting the queer rights movement, the gay rights,
right,
movement in America. And in 1970... Sylvia had joined the Gay Liberation Front with Marsha P. Johnson, which is a radical gay rights movement that eventually gave way to the Gay Activists Alliance. And it's with that group that she worked with them to help pass a gay rights bill in New York. She was actually arrested at one point for climbing the walls of City Hall in a dress and heels to crash a closed door meeting. And this is one of my favorite stories. They go to attend this meeting at the Greenwich Independence Democrats, and they wanted to bring a petition for this gay rights bill. The councilwoman leading the meeting continuously refused to even look at the petition, because while they were crafting this gay rights bill, the whole issue of transgendered rights was it still to this day is something that makes,
right,
a lot of people uncomfortable. She got so frustrated that she took a copy, walked up to the councilwoman, and hit her over the head with it.
Amazing.
When the bill was finally passed in 1986, it did not include any language addressing the need for the protection of drag queens, trans people, or other gender variant people who did not fit neatly into the mainstream gay community that appealed to lawmakers. When she discovered this, Sylvia's response was, quote, "Hell hath no fury like a drag queen scorned."
She is right.
After this whole work trying to get this passed,
right,
1970 rolls around. This is literally the next year. And her and Marsha P. Johnson start the thing that would define them. And that was, they started a group called the Street Transvestite Action Revolution, or STAR. Now, STAR offered services and advocacy for homeless queer youth. They fought for the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act in New York, which prohibited the discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in employment, housing, public accommodation, education, credit, and the exercise in civil rights. Now, the bill was defeated in 1971.
Boo.
It was reintroduced in 1990, defeated in 1993, and then passed in 2002. So it ended up eventually being passed, but it took a very long time.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about STAR, though, is that it really was as grassroots as you could possibly get. Most of the members were sex workers. And Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia, they gave a portion of what the money they made to STAR to fund it, and convinced all of the other members who were also sex workers to give a portion of their proceeds,
wow,
to STAR to fund it as well. Eventually, they actually started their first office space in an abandoned trailer truck that was just left on the side of the road.
Oh my gosh.
Then one day, the truck drove away with everyone still inside it, and all but one of them managed to get out of the truck before it drove away. After this, they were kind of lost without a home, and
right,
another queen named Bubbles Rose Marie, which is an
the
amazing
best
name, had a mafia connection.
What?
Who got them into a building at 213 East 2nd Street.
Oh, man.
And they continued doing what they were doing. They provided services. They fed and clothed homeless people. They kept the building going. They hustled in the streets. They paid the rent, or at least
mostly
Sylvia thought they were paying the rent, until the landlord actually kicked them out because Bubbles Rose, who was supposed to be paying the rent, actually hadn't been paying the rent for 3 months. And so the landlord kicked them out. And in revenge, they threw the fridge out the window.
Oh, man.
At a gay liberation rally in 1973, Sylvia was representing Star and gave a speech from the main stage, and she called out hetero cis men who preyed on vulnerable members of the community. And she also said that LGBT prisoners who sought help, quote, do not write women, they do not write men, they write to Star.
Wow.
She also said, you go to bars because of what drag queens did for you, and these bitches tell us to quit being ourselves.
Whoa.
Yeah. After Star, for the rest of her life, Sylvia focused on giving back to her community. She volunteered at food pantries. She helped give out food to homeless people. She lived basically as a homeless person for most of her life, but still she was, you know, helping people. She ended up at one point living at a pier, and she became basically like the mother of this entire group of people, and she helped people get food and get connections and get money. She worked tirelessly for the queer population. Although she was active with Star for most of the 70s, the organization, quote, officially died in 1973, according to Sylvia, basically because she just became so disheartened by the state of the gay movement and basically like Sisyphus rolling that rock up the hill. And she actually became so disheartened at one point that she had tried to kill herself by walking into the Hudson River, which is where, remember, Marsha had been found dead in the Hudson River.
Ugh.
And she actually, Sylvia, tried to kill herself in the same place where Marsha had been found.
Wow.
She revived Star in 2001 in an effort to make the murder of a trans woman, Amanda Milan, well known to the public.
Mm.
But unfortunately, she passed away February 19th the next year in 2002 due to complications of liver cancer.
Oh, man.
And I just wanted to finish with one last quote from Sylvia. She said, and this is a year before she died, "Before I die, I will be damned if I'm going to my grave without having the respect this community deserves. I want to go wherever I go with that in my soul and peacefully say I've overcome."
Wow. Ooh, I got chills.
So that's Sylvia.
What an incredible life.
This story for me, what it really underscores is the need in the queer community. And again, I think I've explained this in the past that I use the term queer as an umbrella term for the entire gay community. I don't like using LGBT because it doesn't include all of the different alphabet soup letters that make it up.
Right.
And also it's a reappropriation. Just like we're using the word bitch, we're reappropriating it.
Right.
We're reappropriating the word queer. But what's really important to remember, and I think a lot of people, and especially in our generation, what they don't understand is that we would not have any of our gay rights right now or any of the queer rights that we have right now without drag queens, without Sylvia, without Marsha, without every other drag queen who fought at Stonewall, who marched from Stonewall, and who has led every single Pride March since. Drag queens are not just men in wigs and dresses. They are the reason the queer movement is where it is today. So this is what I say to queer people who say they don't like drag queens. I say, you know what? If it's not your thing, if it's not your cup of tea, that's fine. You don't have to go to the performances, but you do have to respect them.
Right.
You do have to respect what drag queens have done for this community.
Yeah.
So that's Sylvia.
Lovely. Well, get ready for a jump back in time to 1591 in Italy.
Okay.
With Benedetta Carlini. She was born to a middle-class Italian family in the mountains on the outskirts of a town of Pescia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a quick note about this town is China had a monopoly on silk like forever because they're like, we have the secret. We have the silkworms. You don't know.
Nah, they had a whole road named after it.
Right. And so they didn't tell anyone. So in 552, two monks from Italy went to China, stole some silkworm eggs and mulberry bushes, and then sold them to the Eastern Roman Empire. So flash forward like 1100 years.
Right.
to this small town in Italy, and it's a prosperous town that's surrounded by mulberry farms where silkworm cocoons are harvested. So Benedetta's father owned one of these farms. Now, at the time, families would pledge one child to the church to show their devotion. So at age 9, Benedetta's father paid a dowry to the church and gave them his daughter. So she was given to the Sisters of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary, also known as the Theatines. They're kind of a smaller order. They're not as well known. It was founded in 1583 by Ursula Benicasa. a nun of the Order of St. Clair, and she had had visions of the Virgin Mary and St. Catherine of Sen, and she was accused of being possessed by the devil, but the church in Rome cleared her, and so she started her own order and was like, everything's fine. Now, Ursula was actually still alive when Benedetta joined, and her visions were very well known in the convent. In 1617, Ursula even had a vision that Jesus appeared to her, praised her, and promised them salvation. And so she asked Jesus to extend his blessing to those outside the church. And so she was alive.
Oh, very nice.
Kicking.
Yeah.
She died the year later, 1618. And Benedetta, who was there, became the abbess of the convent shortly afterwards.
Oh, wow.
She was very young. She wasn't even 30 yet. But she was reportedly very smart. And she had visions. They started when she was 23, and she was praying one day, and she suddenly found herself in a, quote, garden surrounded by fruits and flowers, end quote. So as her visions continued, she, of course, became known for them. When she would have these visions, they would affect her physically, and she would become unable to communicate or acknowledge those around her. And they often filled her with pain. They would make sleeping difficult. So she was assigned sort of a keeper to watch over her. Bartolomea Crivelli, and she went by Sister Mia, thankfully. And so she had been the body servant for Ursula. So when Benedetta and others in the convent were worried that her visions might be diabolical, you know, they might be the devil, you know, playing tricks on you. But then something happened that made her divinity unquestioned. It was the second Friday of Lent in 1619. And she had a vision that Jesus appeared and told her that, quote, he was God and that he wanted her to suffer for the rest of her life, end quote.
Oh.
And with this vision, stigmata appeared on her. Now, for those of you who don't know.
I don't know.
Stigmata is a condition that's maybe real, maybe not real, almost like spontaneous human combustion. It's maybe it's real, but maybe not scientifically. And it's basically someone's hands having the marks of nails.
Yeah.
So often palms are bleeding spontaneously, but there's no real cut, or there might just be a bruising that looks like it's from a nail, but there's no cause of it. And so that's what stigmata are.
Oh.
They're these sort of holy.
Sure.
Relics.
It's like the mark of Cain, except not bad.
Exactly. So these appear on different people, and you could do a whole bunch of research into what maybe actually causes them and cases of them or whatever. But in the 1600s, I mean, that's going to be very believable. And so Benedetta had these stigmata appear, and so her palms appear to be bleeding or are bleeding. A few weeks later, just 2 days after Easter, she had another vision that Jesus appeared and asked her to give up her heart to him. Now, according to Sister Mia, Benedetta cried out, quote, how can I live without a heart now that you have left me without one? How can I love you? And she fell into a catatonic state for 3 days.
Whoa.
Now, normally, quote, normally, this would have like immediately been accepted as proof. You're a saint, you know, check all the boxes. Here's your sainthood. The church is growing and sort of changing. This is the 1600s, so the Catholic Church is kind of going through the Counter-Reformation.
Okay.
So everything's starting to be a lot taken with a more of a grain of salt and a little more investigation and a little more scientifically even. So a lot of independent religious thinkers had kind of splintered from the church, and so there's a lot of questioning. Now, despite this, though, it's still a small town in Italy, so sort of a small cult started forming around this convent. And initially, Benedetta got a seal of approval from the papacy. She was under a lot of scrutiny, but they came and they did an investigation, and they're like, you're good to go.
You just stamp on your forehead.
Right. She started to have these visions during her waking life as well. She started channeling an angel named Splenditello, which is also an amazing name.
Splenditello.
Right?
It's not like Nutella?
No. It's Splenditello. Splenditello.
Oh. Oh, okay.
And she described him as a beautiful young boy in a white robe. And when she was possessed by him, basically, her voice and mannerism changed. And it was such a notable change that the nun said it was if she had become a young man herself.
Whoa.
Now, at the height of this, Benedetta took herself to the pulpit in front of the whole church and started preaching a sermon, which is a major breach of church regulations
of
at this time for women to preach.
A woman at the pulpit.
Now, in this speech that she gave, it took the form of a wedding between Benedetta and Jesus, channeled through Benedetta. Jesus talked about her holiness and superiority and ended the ceremony by saying that she should be, quote, the empress of all nuns, end quote. And that's when people and all the nuns in the abbess were like, hold the phone.
Right.
The Pope might have said that this was okay, but suddenly I don't think it's okay. I think we're going to investigate this a little bit more.
This may have gone off the rails.
Right. So now, and originally,
Empress
of all nuns. So when she had this vision of Jesus taking her heart from her, initially Sister Mia said that it looked like her heart disappeared, and then she asked for it back, and it looked like it like came back and moved up under her rib cage.
Oh.
And was very supportive of all of these visions.
Okay.
After this sermon, an official investigation into the legitimacy began the very next day. And it was led by a local provost. And after several months, he concluded that the visions were legitimate.
Really?
And she remained in charge of the convent.
Did she become
empress
of all nuns?
However, a lot of the nuns had stopped viewing her favorably, and the cult status that she had achieved outside the convent began to worry the nobles, like the local nobles.
Oh, okay.
Because, I mean, she's going to have more power than them. So in 1622, the investigation was reopened, and this time it was led by two monks from Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of had a reputation for squashing any type of heresy. And so by sending them, the message was very clear that they wanted to invalidate these visions and Benedetta in general. So when they began interviewing the other nuns, they quickly turned against her, claiming that they saw her prick her hands to create the stigmata and that she was having meat and cheese smuggled into the convent. Now, what that's about is she at one point said in this vision as this young man angel that people shouldn't eat meat or dairy. She was like, oh, they were pissed that she was vegan. And then apparently sneaking meat and cheese into the convent.
Interesting.
Then this is when they interview Sister Maya, Benedetta's bodyguard, and they found some concrete evidence to remove her. Now it gets a little technical.
Mm-hmm.
So what the sister told him is that when Benedetta was possessed by Splenditello, that the angel had taken a fancy to Sister Maya, and she told them that during the day the angel taught her how to read and write, but at least three times a week at night, quote, Benedetta would grab her by the arm and throw her by force on the bed, embracing her. She would put her under herself and kissing her as if she were a man. She would speak words of love to her, and she would stir so much on top of her that both of them corrupted themselves. End quote.
Oh my.
And just the wording of that is
oh my.
Strangely wonderful. Like, stir so much on top of you that you corrupted yourselves.
Corrupted,
like, is this
ourselves.
50 Shades of Grey? Like,
I'm going to start using that.
Now, what gets interestingly technical about this is that both Sister Maya and Benedetta said it was not her who had acted in this way, but the angel, who was a man. So the monks then used this as evidence that her visions were diabolical in nature.
Right.
And so they condemned her. And then when I was doing some of my own research on this, there also weren't very clear laws about lesbianism in Italy at the time.
Oh, okay.
And there were more laws about whether or not there was penetration involved, and that would have made it like this is way an issue, but there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sort of this like non-lesbian, non-penetration thing.
Right.
And so they didn't really know what to do with it. So the way for them to say, okay, this is an issue is by saying that it was this angel. And so if it's an angel doing it, but the angel's behaving badly, then like, it's really a devil or it's a demon, because they couldn't really convict her
for
like
being
because
lesbian.
Really like quote unquote, but really like nothing
this
happened.
This is like
they
found a loophole and they're trying to charge them with something else.
Right. So since she had never penetrated her with anything and they only performed oral sex on each other, they couldn't use that law against them because they just hadn't written any guidelines for the law for two women being together.
Right.
Which on the one hand, I'm like, well, it's like the late 1600s in Italy. I'm kind of going to give you a pass on that one.
Right.
Like,
why would you write a law about something you don't think is happening in the first place? Or that you think is so morally corrupt that no one's going to do it.
Or, I mean, and the other thing that I think of too, in a way, is, and I don't know how true this is, I haven't done much research on it, but in more ancient cultures and other ancient cultures, like having a young boy lover when you're the king is like, maybe that's normal and that's okay, but you still kind of had to have kids mm-hmm. and continue the line. So mm-hmm. I think for two women, it's like, why would we even consider that? Because they have to have all the babies. I don't know.
Hmm.
Benedetta was declared someone who had allowed the devil to corrupt her, and she confessed to her sins, so she was spared death. Instead, she was sentenced to permanent hermitage. So she was condemned to involuntary solitary confinement for 35 years until she died.
Jesus Christ.
Right. And the church, right. So the church didn't want the common people to know about her indiscretions because she'd been so highly revered, and so rumors were spread that she voluntarily entered into confinement to be closer to God. When she died, she was given a burial of that of a saint in public, and some people in that area were even told that the church had made her a saint.
Oh.
But of course, that did not
sure.
happen.
No, of course not.
She was then wiped away from the official histories of the Theatines and was forgotten until a historian named Judith Brown rediscovered her story and wrote a book about her called Immodest Acts, The Life of a Lesbian Nun in Renaissance Italy. But it was a very academic book,
uh-huh.
so it didn't actually really sell that
sure.
well. And anybody who bought it to like read up on this sexy hot
lesbian
times,
nun.
It was... not that. It was a research paper, basically. So it didn't really gain any attention until Stephen Greenblatt wrote a rebuttal of it and said that she couldn't have been a lesbian because lesbianism did not exist yet in the 17th century.
Huh?
Right?
Okay.
There's a note here, eye rolls forever, all in caps.
You know, things still exist
right.
even if you don't have names for them.
And that's it. That's her story.
Wow. From sainthood to... she kind of had like the opposite story of Coco
right.
Chanel.
Right. Ooh. Craziness.
Wow.
There's been some plays written about her that now I want to go and read. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey guys, if you are enjoying this podcast, let other people know. Look down at your phone, whatever listening device that you're using, and leave us a rating or review. That'll help other people find the podcast and us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
Hey friends, if you're looking for something else to do to help this podcast, you should go to that app store on your iPhone or Android device and download the Patreon app. There you can find our Patreon page. Look for Ursula Major Productions. There you'll find bloopers, deleted scenes, extra information about the women we do on this podcast, and you get to interact with us as well at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor and on the Patreon app. Thanks.
So this week we're going to do an interview, or I'm getting ready to go off and interview my wonderful, amazing, talented, beautiful friend, Roni Geva. She and her writing, directing, creative partner, Margaret, have an incredible web series out called Control-Alt-Delete that's been winning festivals literally up and down and all across the country. And I don't know, possibly all across the world. There's been some awesome articles written about it. It's all about abortion.
Abortion.
It's all about abortion. It's actually an abortion comedy. Definitely check it out. You can find the episodes on Facebook. Just search Control-Alt-Delete Show, and we'll get more into the creation and all the stories behind it in just a moment. So I'm sitting here with my friend Roni Geva.
Hi.
Roni is one of the writers and creators and directors and producers and actors and all of the things of an amazing web series called Control-Alt-Delete, which is an abortion comedy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the show?
Yeah. So it's a character anthology. It has 7 episodes, and each episode is based on a true story, but the whole thing is fictionalized, and it all takes place in a fictionalized independent abortion clinic. So each episode is like 2 to 3 minutes of just one woman's story.
Awesome. What was the inspiration behind the show, and why 7 stories?
Well, 7 is a holy lucky number,
ooh,
actually, according to the Torah.
Yes.
Let's get into that. While talking about abortion, actually, I have to say, my co-creator, Margaret, who is a fantastic human being, was on a retreat with our synagogue. Mm-hmm. And she asked our rabbi about the Jewish viewpoint on abortion. And it's like, first of all, not mentioned a whole bunch. But mm-hmm. second of all, apparently there was a story about a man who punched a pregnant woman in her stomach, which...
Whoa.
Whoa. and the baby died.
Sad.
Terrible.
We should not be laughing.
We should not be laughing. And I just knew you would say sad. And then he was tried and was forced to pay a fine for loss of property. Whoa. And not like, you know, for murder. So,
you know, was it a girl baby?
I mean, who knows what kind of baby it was. Mm. But the point is, the extrapolation from that, like right. by the learned men or whatever, is that that was just property. And so in Jewish lore, and I don't know how Orthodox people feel about this, a baby is not a viable human until its head is out of the mother's vagina and or, you know, when they cut you open to have a C-section.
Right.
And so the mother's health, which includes her mental health, is more mm. important.
Snaps to that.
Snaps to Jewish. So that's why seven. It's actually totally not why seven. So the impetus for the show happened because when Margaret Catch, my co-creator, and I moved to Los Angeles, we decided to make a short, and we did. And it did really well and got into a surprising festival, and we were sort of like, oh, I guess we know how to do this. Let's write a feature, because that's obviously the next step. And so we started writing a feature, and we kind of realized, oh, this might take us a few years if we go down this route. So in the meantime, let's continue to be creative and do something else. And Margaret was really interested in the idea of a serialized something. And she said, let's make a web series. And I said, okay, what do you want it to be about? And she said, abortion. And I said, great, but only if it's funny. And she said, great. So then we went on Facebook. And both of us posted, hey, if you have an abortion story that you feel comfortable sharing with us, we would love to hear it. And we interviewed 10 people, including we interviewed each other because mm-hmm. we both had abortions. And then we took, you know, voracious notes. Mm-hmm. And then we interviewed some friends of ours and people that we knew that had worked at clinics mm-hmm. to get sort of their stories of the day-to-day of a clinic. And then we wrote them. And the thing about it was that we really felt strongly that seven of them were viable. Terrible. Just abortion humor is not great.
Sad.
Sad. It's but like we really wanted to make sure that we used humor in all of them. Mm. And there were a few stories where we felt like we just couldn't because the story didn't lend itself to that. And right. because we also felt out of respect for the person who told it to us, we didn't want it. Like, we just...
You didn't want to take that viewpoint on it, take that comedic angle.
Correct.
On certain stories.
Yep. And so, and we also crowdfunded. And at some point it was like, well, do we want to make seven of these really well? Or do we want to make 10 and have them be less put good. Together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. What has been the reaction to Control-Alt-Delete? Now all the episodes are out, right? People yes. can watch all of them.
On Facebook, facebook.com/Control-Alt-Delete show.
Excellent.
Yay.
And I know it's been winning a bunch of awards and going to a zillion festivals, which is amazing.
Thank you.
So I feel like at festivals, you probably get a good reaction, hopefully, because you got in and people are supportive filmmakers. Have you had any adverse reactions online?
Yes.
What has that been like?
It's interesting. So we get, there's a few different kinds of reactions that we get. Of course, there's the usual, what you would imagine from people who are anti-choice, who are like, your mom should have aborted you. Or, you're dumb, you're going to hell, or, you know, whatever. So there, that's like expected, right? Like that's par for the course. And it's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to find any of our contact information online or any of that, because we recognize that there's some crazy out there. But my favorite kind of response is actually the very thoughtful people who engage and are really detailed and expressive in their viewpoint of why they feel how they feel.
Mm.
And actually, in the last few weeks, there's a couple of them that post on everything that we put up. And it's been really interesting to sort of read their viewpoint, because here's my feeling. At the very least, I know they're reading my viewpoint. And maybe they're as stringent in their beliefs as I am in my pro-choice belief. And I would say it's not just pro-choice. I'm pro-woman. You do you, woman. I trust you. I don't need to lie to you. I don't need to tell you how to live your life. I'm pro-woman. And these people who are anti-choice, at the very least, are reading what I have to say. And then giving, some of them are giving a thoughtful response and some of them aren't. And so that to me is exciting, because the whole point we wanted to make a show and use comedy is so that we could have conversations instead of just yelling at each other from across the aisle. Because I'm happy and willing to listen to someone tell me why they're anti-choice. And then I can tell them, okay, cool. Now this is what I think. And we can agree to disagree. And it doesn't mean I think you're a terrible person. And I hope it doesn't mean that they think I'm a terrible person. We just disagree on science.
It's a great answer. Why? I mean, you kind of already answered it, but I'd love to hear more about why you think that this is a conversation that we should be having, why you think it's a conversation we should be having now. Because, as you know, I just made my movie, Banging Lainey, which is sort of hoping to start a conversation on women's sexuality and being very sex positive for women and using, again, humor and art in kind of that way to open a dialogue on a subject that's like, shh, we don't talk about that. So if you can go more into what you're hoping to accomplish or what you have already accomplished in starting this conversation and why you think it's important to have it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So here's the deal. Comedy is magic, and it's historically normalized all kinds of things. So if you think about the Lucy show, right? Lucille Ball helped normalize interracial marriage. And all of a sudden people were like, oh, right, interracial marriage is cool because I watch Lucy every week and she has it and she's my friend on TV, right? But that's like a legit thing, in the same way that people watched Friends and they were like, oh, those are my friends. Or people watched Will and Grace and, oh, I have gay friends. They don't really have a gay friend, maybe, or maybe they do, but they definitely have gay friends that they watch on TV and that they deeply care about because they tune in every week.
Right.
And so, voila, the whole country's conversation about homosexuality changed because of Will and Grace. And so I think that there's so much power to weekly television and media. And when I had my abortion, I was like, dear internet, let's find some positive abortion stories. And guess what? They're not out there. It's very rare. And I always have people say, oh, well, what about Obvious Child? And I'm like, what about it? The one and only film that's positive about abortion. And I know that there's some others and there's some European ones. And I've done plenty of research and I know about every single episode of television ever made that had an abortion episode. I really do, because they're so easy to count on three pairs of hands. Right? And so
yeah.
I think it's so powerful to use comedy in that way. So that's like, first of all, I just want to be able to have a conversation with people. And if comedy allows us to do that, hooray. Second of all, I think that I think what's going on in this country right now is really interesting, as far as there's this awakening where people are like, hey, stop lying to women, or stop not believing women, or stop silencing women's voices, right? The Time's Up movement, the Me Too movement, there's something happening. And of course, when that happens, there's this recoil of the other, which is like, wait, no, I liked it better when women shut up. I liked it better when women didn't talk about their sexuality. I liked it better when women were pregnant and barefoot in the kitchen, right? There are politicians in the House and the Senate that talk about women as objects of basically, you know, to continue the species, we just use women. There we go. It's saddening, really. And so I think with that is also this, there's this rise of anti-choice, right? Because of our current government, which hopefully will change in 2018. Please register to vote. Please register to vote. Please register to vote.
We did not pay her to say this. We end like all our episodes being like, and vote.
And please make sure to register and vote, because America. But the current climate with our president and the House and the Senate and so many of the state legislatures being where they're at and the governorships being where they're at is trying to limit women's choice. And so I believe that one day when our show is on television on the regular, whether it's through the Netflixes or the HBOs or the whatevers of the world, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, all of these people who have been like, oh, I would never, can watch an episode and be like, oh my gosh, that girl looks just like me. That girl or that woman is a mother just like me. She's in her 40s just like me. She's in a situation just like me. And by seeing someone that looks just like them, who is facing this choice and chooses abortion, mm-hmm. we're able to normalize it. Because yeah. 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 women, depending on which study you read, in this country will have an abortion. That's a lot of women. We do not need to be quiet about it. It's just a medical procedure. And the conversation right now is in the hands of men. Mm. And so that is what I hope to change the world, really, right? It's like, what do you want to do? I want to change the world. And then Disney World.
Perfect.
Right?
I love it. On a ride into Disney World on a unicorn.
That's right.
That's what I will do. Farty. I will dress up a horse for you.
Thank you. And then it will fart rainbows as I march in.
Before we turned on the microphones, we were just chatting and catching up and talking about how we both cried so much during Wonder Woman and how it's the best. Were you inspired by Wonder Woman growing up? Who were some of your heroes that inspired you in comedy, in art, in life?
Whoa. Well, I have to say, the most inspiring person I know, this is the cheesiest, is my mom. My mom is such a strong, incredible force of nature. She is a doer. She is action girl, right? If she was a superhero, she would be action girl. And that's been so inspiring because she taught me and teaches me to just be a unicorn on a flaming unicycle of ambition. And I love that. So my mom is definitely like my
that's gonna be my Facebook status in 20 minutes. Be a unicorn on a flaming unicycle of ambition. Copyright Roni Geva 2018.
I mean, yeah, she's a pretty inspiring person. So my mom for sure. And I come from a long line of strong, badass women. So I can't ever let them down, right? I'm like, yeah. These women who survived the Holocaust are like my heroes. So there's that. But then artistically, it's really interesting because I love comedy and there's certain things that I watch that make my heart explode. And I'm trying to think of like a really good example. And the one that I keep thinking in my head is Life is Beautiful.
So oh, I love that movie.
Okay, great.
Oh my God. That movie destroyed me.
Okay, so here's the thing. Life is Beautiful is a comedy about the Holocaust. How amazing and mind-blowing is that? So there's this crazy person who's like, you know what I can do? I can use this art form and then elevate this tale and actually make such a bigger difference because I'm making you laugh while I'm making a really huge point about life. So when I watched that, you know, in my youth, whenever that came out, it blew my mind. And to me, it was like, when I grow up, I want to make that. Right?
Yeah.
Forever. And I'm not there yet by any means, but it's interesting. I was just at this film festival and they were asking us to talk about our storytelling and are we storytellers or are we feminists or are we feminist storytellers? And I said, I'm a feminist storyteller. I just am. I can't help it. It shapes how I look at the world. It shapes how I see things. And I want to change the world through art. I always have. I mean, I wrote a show called The Arab Israeli Comedy Hour. Like, I have a problem. I don't have a problem. I have a mission, I guess. I think, what better way to try to affect social change than through art and comedy? And so, you know, The Daily Show, which I grew up watching, is like the best example of that, you know, right? Of like using comedy to allow for a deeper conversation about stuff that we might be afraid to talk about.
Yeah.
And I want to do that forever.
Makes me think of Get Out as well.
Right.
Yeah.
100%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's make more art like that.
Yes, please.
No offense to the
shapes of waters of the world.
And I'm glad those movies are being made and I like consuming them, but those are not the ones I'm going to make.
But for real, what's next? Are you working on a second season? Are you working on another project?
Yes. Yes.
All the things.
All the things. So we are working on that feature and I'm working on finishing it. We are also working on a second season and we also have a pilot and a show Bible and we're starting to work on full season episodes that aren't a web series version. Right. So this is for a half hour workplace comedy. And the thing that's really exciting is that we have this proof of concept that is about these individual women, but our show for television is a half hour workplace comedy. And so what we've been doing is actually interviewing clinics and people who work at clinics. And they have the most amazing and compelling and beautiful stories of joy and hilarity and absurdism, and also of people changing their mind. The stories are so inspiring and beautiful that it gets me so stoked and just riled up to sit and write so that we have 10 full episodes instead of just the pilot and a show Bible, you know?
Right.
So that's what's next, is lots of writing and then making a second season for the web series that's going to be the stories of the people who work there.
Ooh! So tell everybody again where they can check out the show.
Facebook.com/control-alt-delete-show.
Beautiful.
You're beautiful.
Mm-mm. I think that's it. Thank you. I love you. You're amazing and beautiful.
I love you. Oh my, you're amazing and you're beautiful. And thank you for having me. I'm so honored.
Of course.
I should say that you're also one of my heroes.
Mm-mm. Now I'm going to cry.
Great. Cry then.
That was so cool.
Thanks.
She sounds amazing. Ugh,
I love her. Ugh. I love her.
Thank you for that.
Of course. Thanks, Roni. And now, cause of the week?
Yes.
I thought it would be fitting to do the Los Angeles LGBT Center.
Building a world where LGBT people thrive as healthy, equal, and complete members of society. They value respect, excellence, inclusiveness, innovation, and integrity. They do so much work in the community. You can find them at lalgbtcenter.org.
Awesome.
Yes. Well, all right. That'll do it for another episode of The Bitchery of History, our last one of Women's History Month.
Aww.
Aww. If you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can find us on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast,
Instagram at The Bitchery of History,
and on Facebook, just search The Bitchery of History.
Join our discussion group. It's awesome.
Yes.
As always, we could never make this podcast happen without our amazing team. So thank you to Kim,
Jeanette,
Jess,
and Sydney.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.